Hey guys, here's a talk Jules did with Frank Ford of the Improv Troupe 4-Day Weekend, who he got connected to through our mutual friend Yelena, owner of Spirit and Flesh magazine. I highly recommend you guys check this one out. I love it. And please buy the book, Happy Accidents, The Transformative Power of Yes And, at Work and in Life.
We've been doing 4-Day Weekend comedy for 20 years, but we had all been banging around doing comedy probably about 4 or 5 years before finding each other and starting a 4-Day Weekend in 1997. In my particular case, I was recruited out of college by Texas Instruments. And if you've ever used a graphing calculator, you're welcome. I worked in their consumer products division, and I worked on graphing calculators and science equipment and electronic educational toys for children. And that's what brought me to Texas, originally from Ohio.
Wow.
And then while I was here, I got into, the comedy circles in Dallas, and ultimately David Ahern, David Wilk, Troy Grant, and myself found each other, liked each other. And then in 1997, we said, hey, let's do our own show. And that was sort of the genesis for it. But we had been banging around in town, either in stand-up or in improv circles, probably 4 or 5 years prior to that.
Cool.
Yeah.
Do you know Donald Glover?
No, Donald Glover.
He's a comedian, right? And he's an actor, but he's also a rap star, the Childish Gambino.
Oh! Yes.
And so you, Frank Ford, you have a comedy troupe. You've also written this book. You're a keynote speaker at events. So you are basically, you fit the profile of the modern Renaissance man, someone that doesn't have such a strict focus, but your skills in entertainment are transferable to these other areas, and you're spreading happiness. You're giving people constructive tools through the books, but also just sort of like giving people uplifting catharsis through comedy. And so comedy is very much part of our culture, and comedians are often kind of like modern day philosophers. You know what they mean? They're sort of subverting people's expectations and getting them to open their minds and think about taboos or whatever it is that makes them uncomfortable. So
I have to tell you, it's so funny. I'm, again, being a comedy fan, I grew up, and one of the comedians that I enjoyed was Steve Martin. And the reason I enjoyed Steve Martin so much was because he was called a Renaissance man. He played the banjo. He was successful at stand-up. Then he was a writer. He wrote for television. Then he was in films. And the guy just did it all. So, and I got to tell you, I always thought, man, that would be really cool in your career if you could reach the place where someone, because you can't call yourself a Renaissance man, but somebody, you can't. It's like calling yourself courageous. I'm courageous. You can't say that. Other people can say you're courageous. Other people can say you're brave. And other people can call you a Renaissance man, but you can never call yourself that. And to hear you say that and couch it, I got to tell you, you just made a childhood dream come true with this phone call. I gotta be honest with you. It's true. Because I always, what's funny, though, is and you're touching on something, and you are 100% right about sort of our approach to improv comedy. And we'll talk about this here in the course of the interview. But that philosophy, that yes and philosophy, when you practice that enough, you start to realize, this just doesn't apply to improv comedy per se. It could be, let's write a sketch show. Okay, all right, we did that. Okay, well, let's write a television show and sell it to 20th Century Fox, and then we did that. Let's come up with a toy in a children's book, and we did that. And so you're right. Once you start to apply it, you start to do. It's not this strict, sort of stringent sort of code, that you abide by. It's basically creativity, and how do you express your creativity in all of these different forms and mediums that are out there. And just coming from that improv yes and background, certainly you don't think in a linear fashion. You think in more of an abstract way. And it applies when you begin thinking in more of the abstract, then of course the applications are endless and limitless.
I feel that.
Yes.
So let me see how we're going to, I want to see how I'm going to organize this. So
okay.
Do you mind if I record the phone call just so I can like refer to it?
Not at all.
Okay, cool. So yeah, that's really funny. When it comes to like, what can or can't you call yourself? Do you know what I mean? There's that show.
Yeah.
There's that showman's dilemma, right? When
yes.
It's sort of like you want it. You got how much do you puff? How much do you puff your feathers? Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I think though, it's kind of a it's such a funny time, right? When you think about how many, like, I know when I look at my parents, for example, like I see people who I consider older than me and wise and in some ways like relate to younger digital sort of internet meme cultures, and then individuals who are like completely separate from it as well. Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
and it's
absolutely, yeah, 100%. Yeah,
like young people grew up like recording everything they do with the sexting and the videos, and then like, you know, you have so like famous careers have been made off of sex tapes. Now our president was a former reality star, his wife's, you know, posing nude everywhere, and it's sort of like, what is controversial anymore? You know, what is gonna sort of bar you from, you know, reaching the goals you want to have, right? I have a friend, his dad, on his website, he sells leather, and so it's like he calls himself the Leather King, right? But so like now, so when people, what's so funny is, so other people have written about him in like magazines or you know, like industry papers, and they all call him the Leather King simply because he called himself the Leather King. And so like, we all kind of laugh at him. Do you know what I mean? But then it's also sort of like, well, he also kind of is. So
yeah, it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, I mean, it's like, hey, if I call myself the Leather King enough, I guess other people start calling me the Leather King, and ergo, I'll be the Leather King, and here I am. You know, so I that's really funny, but yeah. I mean, he is the Leather King, I guess, right?
Well, but now, so now you can definitely tell yourself you are a Renaissance man. Jules says so, right?
Good. Hey, yeah, you know, I think semi-facetious about it, but it's true. That's one of those things, like I said, like you know, calling yourself brave or courageous, you can't call yourself a Renaissance man, but if somebody else does, then you can say, hey, I didn't say it.
Hey.
Rules said it. So it's got to be true, you know?
Well, I always say it's not cockiness if you back it up.
Oh, that's right. That's, you know what's funny, too? You're talking about just the social media. You know, my mom, like you, your generation, you guys, like you said, you grew up always having that technology, that capability, right? So you grew up literally being able to be the star in your own film. You knew you could record yourself, and you had a way to put it out there through YouTube or Vine or what have you. And then on the other end of the spectrum is that older generation, like my mom, who we got her a computer. She never turned it on. But we got her a cell phone. She never answered it. She knows nothing about Facebook. She knows nothing about digital camera rolls. My mom has completely abandoned whatever that techno world is. And then in between is a person like myself. who has seen things change with social media, like what you're talking about. You know, when comedy in 1997, you know, a lot of people in America now have seen Whose Line Is It Anyway? Or they get that people on Saturday Night Live come from an improv background. They've probably been to an improv show somewhere along the way. But even in the 90s, you know, improv was still the redheaded stepchild of comedy, you know, compared to stand-up, let's say. Because all the big names who got their own shows, like Jerry Seinfeld, amongst others, went through stand-up. And the way that you did it, there was sort of this mentality that was born out of a meritocracy. You know, you had to grind. You had to pay your dues. You had to put your time in. You did all the hell gigs. And that was sort of worn as a badge of honor because you knew, okay, I'm going through this. I know it's going to take time, but it's a meritocracy and cream will rise to the top ultimately. And then we'll get our shot doing this or that or what have you. But now you have the ability, like you were saying, to leapfrog all of that with one YouTube video that gets 2 million views. All of a sudden now, you could be a household name because you put on a Chewbacca mask and filmed yourself laughing. Whatever it is, that could get you an agent now. as you recall, when that woman put on the Chewbacca mask, and of course everyone's like, "Oh, it's the Chewbacca mask woman. We love her." that did not exist.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I started, okay, that whole, you know, the expediency of all of that, the efficacy of all of that, came about within the last really, you know, 5 to 10 years with you know, broadband being ubiquitous, Wi-Fi being ubiquitous, and everybody being able to upload or download at the speed of light. So yeah, it's a different dynamic now a little bit. So you're competing with a lot more, and there's just a different way to go about doing things, which is fine. But yeah, that didn't exist back in the day.
Well, I feel like I like what you said about cream rising to the top, because in a lot of ways, cream rises to the top, but it also kind of, it stays there and floats, right? Like you can have bubbles. Can yes. Sort of like rise to the top and pop, and then, you know, they're gone, or whatever made them up, you know, sinks back to the bottom. So there's sort of like this, the market has completely changed, and there's a lot more opportunity for anyone anywhere to sort of gain a larger following or more recognition, or to even just create their own little cultural pocket. Do you know what I mean? Like the ability for people to sort of create and find their own tribes. Like, you know, even like for you, like you guys are based in Texas, you've been there for a while, like you guys have your own nexus, right? You have a 4-day weekend culture, right? And you have a yes. book about the culture that inspired right. your comedy troupe. And so it took you guys time also to find each other. I'm sure you've had working relationships of all sorts, you know, and you kind of learn what works, what doesn't, who you vibe with, you know, who yes. you don't, and sort of you kind of create that synergy through trial and error, right? And so much of the work that goes into that kind of artful science is really never something you can never really show, right? There's so many different ways that people have to build themselves, and a lot of it is really not very glorious at all. It's just, you know, basics.
Well, you know what's interesting about that, and it's really funny. We always say, like, the thing about improvisation is, it looks like, and by the way, we have a great time on stage, and we're friends with each other, and there's a group chemistry and the group mind. But when people come to the show, it's improv. So it looks like we're just a bunch of guys who rolled out of bed, got up on stage, people are yelling suggestions, and then we're just, you know, doing a bunch of make-em-ups in the forms of scenes or songs or what have you. And it looks really fun, and it looks really easy. And we always say that the art is in concealing the art, right? Meaning, you flip open your MacBook Pro, the GUI works, it looks good, you know what the icons mean. You don't care about all the R&D that went into that GUI that makes it work and flow so well. You don't care about all that. You don't care about how the motherboard was put together. You just know, hey, when I gotta, you know, do a message or an email, I'll just go here and it works and it's great. Woo! And it's really easy to use. But there were thousands upon thousands of hours that went into that MacBook Pro and designing it from a user's standpoint, specifically like the GUI and the interface and all of that kind of stuff. You don't care about any of that. You just want it to be fun and easy to use. And the same thing goes with improv, the artisan concealing the art. So when people come up to us and they go, hey, you guys, man, I'd love to just jump up there sometime with you and do some improv. and you're like, well, okay. There is the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours component of it. I mean, you've got to, you know, what they don't see are all those hours that we worked hard and worked together and failed. You know, I always use a simple number, but I always say, you know, and it was when we passed sort of the 5,000 mark of shows. And I would tell.
You guys have done 5,000 shows.
It's 5,500 now.
That is so cool. Wow.
Yeah, right. But just wrap your mind around that. So as you know, improvisation is all hit and miss, right? It's an inexact art form, an inexact science. But if I were to tell you that everything we've ever made up, sang, did on stage, everything we did, we had a 90% success rate, right? You would say, wow, that's what a great hit ratio or success ratio for improvisation. That's like an A-, you know, of everything that you've done the entire time you started. For 5,000 shows, wow, that's amazing. Okay, that means that 10% of the time we sucked. And if you take 10% of 5,000, that's 500 shows where we sucked. Now, if you were to do a show every single day, that would be 1.5 years roughly of shows where you just sucked.
Right.
Now, think about that.
Right.
It took that long or elements of that over a long period of time to hone our skills to get to the place where we are now. And you know, sometimes when clients hire us, we'll tell them, you know, you're not paying us for your show or this show. And they'll say, well, I'm not. We're not paying you for our show. And we say, no, you're not paying us for what you're paying us for are the 5,500 other shows we've done before your show to make sure that your show is great. That's what you're paying us for.
Right?
And when they think about that, they're like, oh, right. That's, yes. Yeah.
It sounds sort of like the logic behind organic food. I'm not sure if you see the connection. It's like you're getting this quality here. You know, we had to throw some things out.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you're getting the best of the best. But in order to get the best of the best, we had to figure out ourselves what was bad. So we've eaten the poison berries. We're not going to sell that to you in the grocery store. I had a terrible stomach ache. I threw up for 3 days. These berries are poisonous. You didn't have to figure that out. I figured it out for you. So please enjoy these delicious organic blueberries.
Right.
You know, it's that kind of a thing. And so, it takes time to get good enough to where other people can watch it and want to do it because you make it look so easy.
So,
but rest assured, the only way or reason it looks easy is because we spent a long, long time doing it.
I never think it looks easy. I know how hard that stuff is, right? Like, and I feel like, and it's not even just the wit that is involved in it, but it's that emotional intelligence that comes with being in tune with your audience. Like, I feel like there's almost a sixth sense when you kind of tell a joke and you can almost like feel the air in the room change. And you're like, I'm not sure if that landed quite the way I meant it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And it's, would you like to talk about, would you want to talk about that in terms of like the instincts you develop being on stage and, how do you turn a joke that goes bad, or how do you stay in touch with your, like, in tune with your audience when you're up there?
Here's the thing about that. Look, it's improvisation. So unlike stand up, you know, we don't write and rehearse and practice a set and then get up and then become a monologist with a microphone under a spotlight. Improvisation, you know, stand up is more about me and improv is all about me. So when we take the stage, we know that as a team, a group mind, we are only responsible for our portion of it. So it takes some of the pressure off, right? So we take the stage, attack the stage, and our philosophy isn't, I'm going to get up there and showcase myself or make me look good. Our philosophy is, hey, look, if I make you look good and you make me look good, then guess what? At the end of the day, we're both going to look good, right? So we go out there with the audience and as a team. And then, yes, do we feed off of their reactions and their suggestions? Yeah, but the thing that always connects us to whatever the audience is, and improv is great because it's such a unique experience. Improv shows are as ephemeral as it gets. That show means the world to you and that audience in particular because it is a you had to be there form of comedy. It just is. That's why it doesn't translate very well. Like if you were to go tonight and you go see an improv show and you taped it with your phone and then you went home and you showed some other people, hey man, I was at this great improv show. Let's watch it on my phone. Those people would be like, yeah, that's okay. You'd be like, no, it was amazing. You had to be there. And you'd be right. Because improv is about being present and being in the moment. If you talk about capturing lightning in a bottle or whatever's in the zeitgeist for that moment, you can't take that out of that theater. You can't take that out of that room. You and the audience realize that you're sharing a singular moment together in time. Right. And it will never happen again, and it never happened before. And because there's that unspoken sort of relationship that you have going into that show, the audience is really into it because they know this is our show too. We're co-creating this show with you. This is our time together. We're going to make the best of it. We're going to have the most fun with it. And then within that, we, being improv comedians, but also human beings, look, the themes we touch on in our show are universal themes. You know, somebody once said, the news that you read in the newspaper or a magazine or see on TV, the news never changes. It just happens to different people. The news is always the same. It just happens to different people. And when you understand these universal themes and connections, not only as a comedian, but as an adult, whether you're doing stand-up or improv comedy, the audience connects with you on that level too, that you're representing humanity. And then, so you have this singular moment in the theater or wherever you are doing it. You have the shared experience of these universal themes. And then you have the cathartic action of healing through laughter. And we all bond together that way too. Because like crying, laughter is very cathartic. And so you're bonding on several different levels here. I've never been asked to sort of deconstruct it. So you're hearing that for the first time. So congratulations.
Thank you. That was great. I love what we're getting. I mean, it's that resonated with me. That resonated with me.
I've never expressed that before in one snapshot like I just did with you there. But yeah, that's you know, now that I think about that, kind of that's what's going on there.
Yeah, I mean, and so I am you now have me thinking much more about the differences between monologuing, stand-up, and improv. But I do see that you're also, you just sold a television comedy to 20th Century Fox, so that's scripted. Are you able to talk about that, what the concept was, or how is that different from improv? Because that is sort of more of the rehearsed, sort of scripted content.
It is. But again, you know what's funny is that all of our writing endeavors, including the book, have been collaborative, right? So even though it's a scripted idea, it came, once again, from collaboration. And the Bermuda, you know, we had, you know, just like, you know, getting to, you know, perform for Congress and meet Obama or get to write this book or do all of the things that we've done. I'm sure you've seen it on our website. You know, being you're from New York and now you're in LA. And you know, the consensus for a long time, I think, was, hey, if you're not in New York or LA, well, you probably weren't good enough. For whatever reason, that's just kind of like, if you're, you know, if you're in New York or LA, you're like, oh my God, well, you know, obviously you've done something. I mean, for God's sake, you've been on Broadway, or you've been in LA, you got on a TV show or movies. And the landscape, because of social media too, has changed over the last 20 years, where it's more spread out now. And people can, right, people can become known for things because they can write a blog. They can show you their, here's my short film, go to Vimeo and watch it, or go to YouTube or what have you. So that really changed. So, you know, when we started, I think the idea of, for instance, selling a television show meant, oh, well, I guess we got to pack everything up, move to LA. But we're yes and guys. And we're like, no, now is that true? Is that really true? Or
exactly.
Can it be done from Dallas-Fort Worth? So we started to talk to people and we went out there and we met with agencies. And initially we were with APA, which was a great agency. And then we began to realize, I'm giving a real Cliff Notes version here, realized, oh, you know what we also need in addition to the agency is a management company, because they would help us, you know, prepare for these pitch sessions and help to sort of craft, you know, our brand or who we are, our profile, as they put it, right?
Right.
And so we started to, we got with a Generate, and Jared Hoffman, who was originally a literary agent for a CAA, and then he was with Generate. Well, once we had that management component, we were able to sort of hone in and focus on what we wanted to do, and eventually the show that was optioned by 20th Century Fox was called The Bermuda Star, and it was about a cruise line, you know, like Carnival cruise ships. So imagine, oh God,
does it go to the Bermuda Triangle?
No. It was the name of, one of those, middle to lower tier cruise ships. It wasn't the Carnival cruise ship. It was a middle to lower, cruise ship. And yes, it would go, the ship's, path was like, yes, around Bermuda and, you know, the different islands. But it basically was a rated R version of The Love Boat with a 20-something as the main character in a nutshell. And that was written based on David Wilkes' experience as a cruise director on a ship called the Bermuda Star in his 20s. And it was funny because that was something that, you know, we all kind of, you know, gathered the concept, and we had pitched other ideas. Like we had.
So are you all? You're all credited as the writers. How many of you are credited as writers on the Bermuda Star?
On the Bermuda Star, that one is just David Wilk and myself. But David Ahern, who also, because David Ahern was working on a film at the time and wrote a film script, but we all worked together on a couple of 4-day shows that we wrote and shot. One was called The Weekend Report. It was like kind of like a scripted version of The Daily Show, sort of a thing, and then the other one was Get Lost. But yeah, we all either were writing in some capacity together, or we would sometimes branch off and write things individually. Like I wrote an entire sketch show without David Wilk or David Ahern, just because I wanted to do sketch, and they weren't involved in that. Just like Ahern wrote a film script because he wanted to do that film. And so over the years, you know, we kind of, it would peel off and do our own thing, but we would always be working together on something else or the show. Like we were always collaborating no matter what.
How often do you guys perform at your theater in Texas?
We perform for the general public every Friday and Saturday at 7:30 and 10. So there's two shows on Friday, two shows on Saturday for the general public. And then the rest of the week, we're booked to do, you know,
private
corporate work, or, you know, there's all kinds of other work that we're having to travel around the country. But for the general public, two shows Friday, two shows Saturday.
That's cool. I kind of want to ask an unrelated sure. question, because we were talking about your scripted work and the difference between improv and that. But so being in Texas, I don't know what the politics are down there, but I was just curious if politics ever play into what comes up at some of your improv, or is that something that's sort of like never really brushed on so much that it's not really relevant?
Yeah, you know what's funny is, now look, if it's in the ether, the zeitgeist, are things going to seep in to the show based on the collective consciousness of the crowd? Yes, of course. However, our particular show, we set out to do a couple of things. One was we always wanted to have fun with people, not make fun of people. Right. Because we just believe, you know, in the laws of attraction, and positive attracts positive and negative attracts negative. So we never wanted to make fun of people. And one of the things that we sort of did, and it's just, it happened organically, but our show is politically agnostic. I mean, it really is. Like we never pick on any one group or set out to have an agenda we just have never done that. Now, are there scenes or songs that are based on something that was in the news? Yeah, of course.
Right.
But we always handle it in a very tasteful way. Like we never want to create any sort of division within our audience or the show, where half the audience is laughing and the other half is going, screw you guys, you know, I mean, whatever. We don't want that, because the whole thing is about coming together and being communal in laughter. It's supposed to be this thing, that this common ground that we can all find and enjoy together and laugh and experience the catharsis together, not remind us of, you know, how we're supposed to be different and fighting each other. So we've remained throughout the 20 years politically agnostic.
I really like that. And what you said about laughing with people, not laughing at people, and the laws of attraction in terms of positivity attracts positivity, negativity attracts negativity. To go to your book, to focus on your book, this is a book that's not just for aspiring comedians. This is a book for anybody, for people in business, yeah. or how would you describe, who is this book for, and tell me a little bit more about that.
Okay, this book, you know, it's based on the Yes And philosophy, which, you know, all of improvisation is based on. But we wanted to write a book that it was for anybody. So, you know, if you're interested in just being a better individual, a better person, you can pick this book up and learn about the Yes And philosophy or active listening, and it will help you as an individual, which will also help you at, you know, at work or with your family or friends, because that's what we learned. When we started this, we took some of the philosophies, principles, and tenets that are in the book, and we applied them to our show on stage. And, you know, as the business grew, you know, we started in Fort Worth. We had a 6-week run at this theater. We were going on at 11 o'clock at night after a musical, Forever Plaid, that was there. And so 6 weeks was the only thing we had committed to. And 6 weeks became 6 years, six months, and 6 months became 6 years, 6 years became 20. Well, along the way, our business was growing. You know, we had to add a staff of people, somebody to operate the ticket booths. Oh, now we got a bar. Okay, we need a bar. Well, okay, well, now we need another bartender in case that one takes off. So all of a sudden, we had a business, but none of us are business majors. Right. So we said, well, wait a minute. We're not business majors. What's our business philosophy going to be? And we thought about it and said, hey, you know that stuff that works really well for us on stage? What if we did that in real life, like off stage, like as business owners? And then all of a sudden, we started to do that with the business, and it opened up all, like you said, there was nothing was impossible. You know, we could sell a show to LA from Dallas, Fort Worth. We could do that. We can perform for Congress and meet the president. We can do that. Nothing was impossible. And then that seeped into our interpersonal relationships with, you know, our significant others, you know, wives, girlfriends, kids, whatever.
Are you all married?
No, not all married.
The founders, are all the founders married?
No. David Wilk is married, but Ahern is in a long time relationship with his girlfriend, and I'm in a long time relationship with my girlfriend. Yeah, so what was really interesting and great was that we realized, oh, this philosophy works for you as an individual. It works for you as a coworker in corporate America, and it also works for large groups of people, like the culture of a company or even the culture of a city. And, you know, we were very, very fortunate to get into Fort Worth, which is a Yes And city, and to be entrepreneurs in residence at TCU, which said, hey, let's teach this at the graduate level at our Neely School of Business. That's a very Yes And university. Fort Worth is one of those blue zone cities. So, you know, former Mayor Mike Moncrief and current Mayor Betsy Price, you know, are part of that blue zone. It's a lot of progressive forward thinking in that area, and we were the benefactors of being in the right city at the right time. But when someone picks up this book, they could be anybody, and anyone can practice those exercises.
So yes, and what does that mean? So like, I'm trying to think of, is that a philosophy where is it encouraging people to try new things or not shut things down? Because I can imagine. I mean, we're talking about girlfriends and wives a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
Like, how does that yes and philosophy apply to cohabiting a space or deciding what you do together with people you like?
Okay, so what we're here, just to kind of give you some context here for what it's born out of improvisationally. You know, when you're on stage and somebody yells out a suggestion, they're like, what, give me a noun, brick, okay, brick, and so now you're on stage, this person, you have a suggestion, it's brick, you're with a couple of other people, your fellow improvisers on stage, you do not have time to sit there and judge that idea. You don't. You can't sit there and go, now is brick the best noun you could come up with? I mean, is that really the best? Should we work with brick or not? Folks, let's take a vote. No, there's no voting. You have to be, you know, improvisation teaches you to be present and in the moment all the time. So it's brick, and here you and I are. We're on stage together, and you and I are going to yes-end the suggestion of brick with no judgment. We're just going to come up together with an idea. We're going to co-create this scene, and we're going to do it together back and forth with lines of dialogue and action and things, and we're just going to go with this stream of consciousness as a group and see where it leads us. Now, when you take that off stage and you start to apply that going with the flow, going with the chi, being present, being in the moment with friends and family and significant others, well, you know, isn't that what you're supposed to be doing when you're with them? I mean, are you supposed, when you're at dinner, are you supposed to be taking pictures of your food and posting it on your Facebook page and checking in? Or are you supposed to be having a conversation with the person you're having dinner with?
Right, exactly.
That's being present and being in the moment. And so when you improvise, you are hypersensitive to those things. And yes, and reminds you that, okay, I'm in the moment. And a lot of people, especially in our society, the default or the knee-jerk is no, or no but, or yes but, because it's fear-based. Nobody wants to look stupid. Nobody wants to be judged. Nobody wants to make the wrong choice, oh my God, or say the wrong thing, oh my God, in today's society, what if I say the wrong thing? So you have this very tepid, pensive approach to life and creativity at work, at home, hanging out with people, and you. But what Yes End does is that it teaches you, okay, be present, be in the moment, and open yourself up to ideas versus giving like a reactionary no. Now, we understand in the real world, do you have to say no? Of course. Yes, of course. I mean, if you're a parent and you had kids and one of your kids came up and said, hey, Dad, can I go out in the middle of the freeway and play baseball? You wouldn't say yes and wear camouflage so it's harder for the car to see. Like, you wouldn't do that. You wouldn't yes and that idea. But what you would do is you would say no to your son, and you would say no because it's a considerate no, meaning you know that, hey, look, son, believe me, when I was a kid, I tried playing baseball on the freeway, and I got hit by a car. You don't want to do that. Tell you what, we're going to play baseball. We're going to play catch, but let's go to the park. Sound good? So yes and is the workaround. And what it trains people, their brains or minds to do, is to default to a more open, a more objective, a more agreeable position in the form of yes and versus an obstinate, reactionary, or confrontational no.
I like that. No, I think that's very clear. And I feel like I feel like it's intuitive to people who might more naturally be comfortable with yes, right? Because you're saying it's fear-based, right? So people who might feel comfortable. Go ahead.
Yeah, no is fear-based. Look, no gives you the illusion of control, but it stifles creativity. With yes and, you're having to relinquish control.
Right.
But it opens up the door to all kinds of creativity and possibility. See, that's the thing with it. And that's the thing about yes and. You're not trying to assume the burden of everything. You are relinquishing control by saying yes and kind of seeing where the flow or the chi of things goes versus no, which shuts down all possibilities and then gives you the illusion of control, which you really don't have. You're just shutting yourself off from all this other stuff that's out there. And it's crazy. Why would you do that?
Interesting.
So, and then, of course, that helps in relationships because guess what? If you're not digging your heels in and taking a confrontational position of no, well, that means you're going to listen to the other person and you're going to kind of hear them out and hear their point of view. And guess what? When that happens, that's called civil discourse or idea sharing. And when you go back and forth that way, well, it's what we always say in improv is what we come up with together is far better than what we would have come up with individually.
Right.
And that goes for groups of people, that goes for societies, that goes for countries, that goes for the world, that goes for small towns. Yes, this is a community. Improv is based on community and collaboration. The world, the human condition is based on community and collaboration. You know, when you start to really unfold the philosophy of improvisation and yes, and it takes on a very philosophical, existential way of life.
This is very cool. I love everything you're saying. This is very cool. I love that I'm getting all this. So I'm looking at your website and I clicked on the who we are and I see all you guys, you have these beautiful suits on, you're all matching. And it's like, I've read a couple of business books and saw some advertisements lately for different companies. And there seems to be this cult trend and basically like comparing company cultures to cults, right? So like SoulCycle or Equinox, they'll say is a cult. I'm not sure if you've seen any ads. There was a North Face ad in Times Square and it literally said cult community and it had a group of mountain climbers, right? And then you've got the new... And you've got the new American Horror Story coming out this season, all about cults.
Clown cult that they have, right?
Right. So there's this, and do you know who Joe Rogan is?
Oh yeah, yes, I'm very familiar.
Did you see his stand-up special on Netflix recently?
You know what? I haven't seen his recent stand-up.
But it's called.
I've seen his stand-up before.
It's called Triggered. And he has a 10-minute bit on how people need to join cults, but they need to differ. This is real, right? But they need to be able to differentiate between good and bad cults, and it's a very funny bit. And you know the number one business books in the Amazon store for 2 years. One was a book called Bold. Another was a book called 0 to 1. I might be a little off on how long they're the number one business book, but they were prominent. They were New York Times bestsellers, number one business books on the Amazon store, and both of them had entire chapters on how people need to start cults, right? For the health of society. And it's just like, it's just so fascinating because it's been so stigmatized, but I feel like it's so ripe for comedy, this concept that it seems like all these marketing savvy people have basically, you know, they've come up with this idea that, okay, we're going to reclaim the word, right? It's sort of like you have these ethical sluts are sort of like reclaiming the word, you know, like, Miley Cyrus is, you know, sort of destigmatizing, you know, sexual openness. And now you just have people that are like destigmatizing cults. And I feel like you guys, 4 Day Weekend, I'm looking at your website. You guys do have a unique company culture. You even have your own book, right? And I wonder if you've ever imagined having that description ascribe to you guys as having a unique company culture, sort of like a Upright Citizens Brigade or a SoulCycle, because you guys are sort of also, you're preaching a philosophy and a lifestyle in a sense with your comedy.
Yes. We are for sure. And you know what? We've never internally looked at it that way, or like from a cult perspective. There is a stigma attached to that, you know, that would be, but I do get kind of what you're saying and why it's fodder for comedy, but what you're saying is right. You know, we are trying to get a philosophy out there that we know worked really well for us. But here's the thing about the Yes and or improv culture. You know, we took it and put our own thumbprint on it and molded it and used it in a way that was beneficial to us. And like in the book, we give everybody the seeds for the basis of the philosophy. But however they use it or mold it to fit whatever it is they're trying to do, it's very malleable. And so our version of Yes And, which resulted in an improv comedy theater and selling a show to 20th Century Fox and doing all this, that may not be what somebody else uses Yes And for. It may be completely different. It may be solely for, you know what, I can't even relate to my kids anymore. I'm going to give Yes And a shot. Maybe my teenage son will talk to me. Or, you know what, I'm not a comedian. I'm a farmer. But I got to figure out a way to, you know, get my crops. And maybe there is a workaround solution that I can think about using Yes And or whatever the thing is.
Right.
It's malleable, right? Now we, if you'll notice, because you're looking at the photographs, in our case, very early on, we always wore a suit and a tie because, A, we back then, if you were in an improv group, sometimes a lot of comedy groups would take zany and wacky photos. So it was almost like, hey, look at us. We're wearing rainbow clown wigs. We're funny. I mean, we got to be funny, right? We got rainbow clown wigs on.
Right.
And we always thought, yeah, no, you know, why don't we just dress professionally?
It looks sharp. You guys look smart. I love the style. And I think it's very, yes. I think it's very attractive. And I think it's sort of like, it looks serious and smart, yes. Right? And I think I like how it's contrasting the fact that you guys are comedians, right? I feel like
that's right.
To me, that I don't know what that sort of pull is, but it feels more layered.
I have to tell you, and I'm gonna just throw a quick compliment out your way. We've done a lot of interviews. I've done a lot of interviews. You're very very perceptive, and you're making some very astute observations here that I've never heard anyone talk about with us or call out the way that you're calling it out. You're gravitating towards things that we intentionally did, but we've never spoken about. And to your point, it was, yeah, man. I mean, we let our content and the show speak for itself. We're like, we know that the content's funny, the show's funny. If you come, you're going to have a good time. But we didn't want to undermine the credibility of the business we were building or the brand we were creating by taking wacky, zany photos. You know, I mean, you're already catching a lot of crap when you're in your 20s anyway. And so if you're trying to get out there and build your name and a business on some level, especially in your 20s, you want people to take you seriously.
Right.
Like, we're serious about this.
Right.
Oh, yeah, whatever. You got a man bun. How serious can you be to something? I'm serious. You know, so that's, look, that from early on when we were in our 20s, we felt the same way, of course. It never changes. It's universal, right? We felt we were all 20-somethings once. We felt the same way. So the suit and the tie was like you said. It was, if you're going to claim to be the smartest guys in the room, you probably should look like it. If you claim to be professional, you should probably look professional. And so that became sort of just the way we photographed. We took, if you go back and look at some earlier photographs, there were some really artistic, fun, artsy type of photographs, but we were always in a suit and tie. So no matter what setting we were in, no matter what situation we were in, here were these guys in a suit and tie, and this is a comedy group. And it did instill, as it turned out, a lot of, what's the word I'm looking for? Faith. People would have a lot of a trust in us, especially when we were doing corporate work, right. You know, because, you know, people are like, hey, do we really want to bring these guys in for this? And this is a pretty important thing that we're doing here. But when they'd see us in a suit and tie, they'd be like, I work in corporate America. I wear a suit and tie.
Right.
Most comedians are wearing a suit and tie. They kind of look like me. Okay, you know what? Well, let's talk to these guys. Maybe they know a little something more about business than we're giving them credit for. And so that really helped us on the corporate side of things. But it was an intentional decision from day one to always photograph the group that way for that reason. And it's very interesting that you picked up on that. It's very astute of you.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad you're getting it sounds like you're getting as much from this as I am.
Listen, just the dirty little secret is I'm a student in life. I mean, I will always be a student. So I, even when I was teaching, I would tell my students, you know, hey, the dirty secret is I'm learning as much from you as you are from me. And it's the same thing with this interview. Yeah, talking to you and getting your perspective. Yeah, well, this is absolutely edifying for me and educational for me. I always am sponging up stuff and perspectives. It's great. So yeah, this is as meaningful for me because I love the back and forth, man. It's like I've known you for a long time for whatever. It's fun. This is a great interview. I'm enjoying it.
Thank you.
Yeah,
that means a lot.
Yeah.
Based on your uniforms and the attention you guys have given to your to your cultural image, to your group image. I'm very curious. You've said you've done comedy for Congress, or you've done comedy for, you said you did comedy for Obama, or you did, that's really cool. Not a lot of comedians can say they've performed for that kind of audience. Were they an easy audience, or were they a hard audience, or what was that like? How did that happen?
Okay, it's a kind of a crazy story, but okay, so over the years, one of our corporate clients, who is still one of our corporate clients, but one of our first big ones was Southwest Airlines, all right? They're in our backyard here, and Southwest Airlines is a great airline company, and they have a great corporate culture. And they had heard about us and saw the show, and they heard about and at the time, we were just putting together sort of our Yes and keynote. This is before the book. And one of the first companies to hire us was Southwest Airlines because they loved our show and they loved the few small keynotes that we did for their leadership teams. And so Southwest Airlines brought us out one time and we were doing a keynote for this big group of people. There must have been like 150 Southwest employees there. And
how many? How many?
150 or 200.
Okay.
Because our keynote is very interactive. Like we'll talk and we'll talk about Yes And, but we always get people up to do interactive exercises around that. We'll have them do Yes And exercises or listening exercises. So we will show them, you know, what we do on stage, and then we show them how to do it themselves with each other, and then how they can apply it to their business. So it's always a lot of fun and energetic. People are, you know, we're not just sitting there with a PowerPoint presentation. That is not what we do. We're very interactive, and it's a lot of fun, and it's funny, and it's entertaining. We always have a great time with the audience. So we're doing this for Southwest Airlines. Southwest Airlines said, hey, there's going to be a writer here. He's doing an article for our in-flight magazine, Spirit Magazine. Like American Airlines has American Way. I'm sure you've seen it, of course, on your flight from, you know, if you flew American, you see the American Way magazine. But also, so Southwest Airlines has their own in-flight magazine. But we said, ooh, would he want to write, you know, about us? And they're like, oh, no, you know, we can't promise that. Well, as it turned out, this guy was going to write a little paragraph or two on creativity in the workplace. But cool. When we knew he was going to be there, Southwest Airlines said, do you mind if the writer watches? We said, watch? What? Why doesn't he come in and do the keynote, like participate in it? So he did. And he loved it. This little blurb, this two-paragraph blurb that he was going to write for the magazine, ended up being a four-page article on creativity in the workplace, and it was all about us and that keynote. And it was not supposed to be that. So all of a sudden, cool, we are in Southwest Airlines, in-flight magazine on every flight.
Cool.
And who picks up a copy? A congresswoman out of your state now, California, Linda Sanchez. She picks it up. She reads about it. And she's like, wow, this is really interesting, this Yes And. She goes back to Washington, walks into John Larson, who was head of the Democratic caucus, puts the magazine down on his desk, and he says, our meetings suck. That is a true story. As John Larson told us that, he said, she walked in and said, our meetings suck. We need to get these guys to come in and talk to us. So all of a sudden, we get a call from John Larson, and we thought, this isn't real. But as it turned out, it was 100% real. And we went out and we did Yes And for Congress. I mean, Nancy Pelosi was there.
That is so fun.
Isn't this crazy?
That's so fun.
Your Barney Frank was there. And so we did Yes And for them. And then, unbeknownst to us, afterward, Barack Obama was there for the dinner and the dance and that. And we were sequestered off with the members of Congress doing this Yes And. And then it was a surprise that Obama was there, and we ended up meeting him after we had done our keynote. It was just...
That is so cool.
We've worked with a lot of different people over the years, like Colin Powell and Rudy Giuliani and George W. Bush and James Carville.
All of them.
All of them, right? But what's funny is normally those people don't... Like a Colin Powell did, but sometimes they're a little wiggy about taking group shots. And we asked Obama, and everybody said, can the entire improv group take a photo with you? And they're like, yeah, sure.
So that's great.
Our photo is the whole group together with Obama, which is really unusual for someone of that caliber and stature. I mean, the president.
Well, Obama was just so cool. Obama was just like on in a league. Obama was just in a league. Obama's just in a league of his own. There's a comedian, I'm not sure if you know who he is. Have you ever heard of the Fat Jew?
No. No, what is that?
Well, he has 10 million followers on Instagram.
Oh my God.
So he's like, he's one of the biggest meme comedians.
Okay, meme comedian. Okay.
He's like a memer, and he's got 10 million followers, and he'll do events where he shows up and he's himself, and he's just a totally over the top, larger than life, kind of spaced out character. But he's got his on his Facebook, his featured photo is him like with giving like a diplomatic handshake to Barack Obama, and I think it's one of the funniest photos I've ever seen, because it's like, is it showing the Fat Jew is sort of like, it makes him look like this diplomat or something, and it's just so funny. But no, I love that. Politicians, like, you know, it's well, this isn't really about politics, but yeah, I feel like there didn't used to be career politicians, right? So I like it when they're less uptight, do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and like,
it was a cool moment, because it was just like, yeah, I'll take it with the whole group. And it was a really cool moment for the entire group to be taking a picture with the president of the United States.
So
cool. I'll never forget that, and how generous he was to do that. I mean, it really was. It was so generous of him, you know. I mean, a guy like that doesn't.
He's a cool. Obama's a cool guy.
He's a cool guy, man.
Yeah, he's a cool guy. So that is awesome. You guys have a very interesting and exciting career and little group. And
oh, thanks, man.
And I think it's something that, like, is it's something that I admire and look up to a lot, as far as, because I know how hard it is to accomplish those things and what it's like to really like build something of your own and like to be able to live what you love doing. And then also you found other ways so that it's, you guys are doing the opposite of pigeonholing yourselves. You're really broadening your horizons and finding a lot of different creative outlets from your beginnings. And I think that is why you guys are like such a perfect match, and you in particular, for having a feature in this magazine. I feel like I got a lot, and I also don't want to hold you too long. Is there anything that we didn't talk about or that you would like to focus on? I noticed that you were talking a lot about the yes and what you were doing for the politicians. That's specifically your keynote, right? Like you have a specific keynote.
And the thing is just I'll tell you one other little story or anecdote here, and you could use it for whatever you want. But you know, the main thrust behind this is that, you know, back in 2008, we had the Great Recession, right? And we were on a corporate gig. And the headline on the corporate gig was Lehman Brothers files for bankruptcy, right? So here we are, and our revenue streams at that point were based on the ticket sales from the theater, but also corporate work that we did. Well, as you know, a lot of companies tightened their purse strings after 2008. Like, there wasn't money for entertainment.
Right.
So that was a big crossroads for our business. And this is where yes and really kicks in, because it was, you know, they say necessity is the mother of invention. Well, the keynote came out of that. Our entertainment revenue streams dried up for a while, but we still had a staff of people. We still had a cast. We still had to pay all our bills. So we needed to develop a new revenue stream. Well, in corporate America, you may not have money for entertainment, but you will always have money for continuing education.
Right.
And if you develop a keynote,
that's very good.
They can justify bringing in a keynote speaker, a motivational speaker. And so our keynote was really born out of that. And then that keynote became the fastest growing part of our business and became so popular that a lot of people said, would you put this in a book? So, because not everybody can come to one of these things to get it out there. And it really was a moment, an aha moment for us. The book really was that we want to share this with everyone, because anybody can do it and anyone can parlay it into whatever they want to do. And so we just really felt it was just a really cool thing that we could give back to people that couldn't be in one of our workshops or keynotes. It was a way nationally in another way. And that's the thing, and I'll speak here a little metaphysically or existentially, is that, you know, improv, because you're making each other look good on stage, it really is this craft that's all about ultimately being in service to others,
right?
Whether it's your audience, whether it's each other on stage, versus being in service to yourself. And the book is an extension of that service to others that we want to get out there. And we do it with our training center too, but the book is just a way for us to get it out there nationally, where other people who can't come to Dallas-Fort Worth to see it or experience it get a chance to read about it and use it. So that would be the only other thing I would say about it.
I love that. That is such a nice note. It reminds me of kind of like a yin-yang relationship between, you know, you guys, by being orators or performers or entertainers, you know, that focus on the group, right, and being in service to others, right?
Yes.
But you're also doing that by, I'm trying to think of like an elegant way of saying this without it being kind of nerdy, like, you know, this selfish gene drives the altruistic vehicle. They're sort of like, by being by building yourselves up, you're also able to you're also able to share and like it's about you guys, but it's not just about you guys. Do you know what I mean? And I feel like our language tries to make it this black and white dichotomy. Like you're either an egotist or a narcissist, or you're a selfless, you know, egalitarian. And I feel like sometimes people kind of miss that you can kind of, you can be both, right? Like you can be, you can be the center of attention without it being all about you.
That's right. You know, and the way that you kind of thread that needle, you know, we always say that after the show, the worst thing in the world, because we always go out in the lobby and we'll take pictures with everybody and thank them for coming, because we really are grateful and appreciative that they come out to support the show. Worst thing we can hear is if somebody singles one of us out and says, "You were my favorite." and here's why. Because it means that those guys were doing their job making me look really good on stage, like setting me up really well. So in this person's eyes, I look like the star. They were doing their job, but obviously I wasn't doing my job making them look good enough. The only thing that we ever want to hear, and this is the truth, is you guys were great. 4-day weekend is great. So is the attention on us? Yeah, but it's on us as a collective. It's on us as a group of people doing something. And then in return for that, we want to help people heal through laughter. We want to take their mind off of stuff. And we certainly want them to know that they're not getting a $25 show for $25. We want them to feel like they got a $100 show for $25. So it's a really nice back and forth symbiotic relationship. But you're right. It is that, you know, we had to work hard and sacrifice, you know, and sometimes, you know, in relationships that being gone on the weekends comes at a sacrifice. But we did it because we knew, gosh, if we get good at this, our reach or the people we can affect in a positive way will be much greater. But you're right. It's not about us. It really isn't. And we never look at any success that we've had by saying, "I did this" or "I did that." It's always, "We did this. We did this together." We'll even say to the audience at the beginning of every show, "You're going to help us co-create this show." And once they hear those words, they're like, "You're right. We're in this together." The audience, bar staff, the ticket girl, you guys, the lighting guy, and the piano player over there, we're all going to co-create this show. Yeah. And that sort of is that altruistic sort of group community attitude and atmosphere we engage in every day.
I love it. And I don't want to thank you for helping me co-create this interview. I don't really want to take too much credit because you have such a wealth of experience, and there's so much breadth in your focus that it really kind of helped. It just kind of naturally has given me a very full interview.
First of all, thank you very much for taking the time out to speak with me and talk about 4-day weekend. Again, I apologize for the mix-up at the beginning. That was my bad. I don't know how that slipped through the cracks. Really, Matt, it was a pleasure and an honor speaking with you, and congratulations on the move to California. And you're a very good interviewer, man. I thoroughly enjoyed it. So
Frank, thank you so much.